I'm the doctor, by the way.
You're listening to Pieces of Eight, the Doctor Who podcast that's still fighting the good fight. We're on the trail, as ever, of those sections of the Doctor Who universe that feature the incarnation of the Time Lord, as played by Paul McGann. I'm Kenny Smith.
And I'm Matt Michael. You join us as we resume our quest to feature the Eighth Doctor's exploits, whether on screen, in books, novellas, full cast audios, short stories, comics, animations, talking books, magazines, and more.
There certainly is more. I have to say, Matt, last week, Tina joined me to co-host, and she got through that list, and English isn't her first language, so I'm afraid that's Tina 1, Matt 0 for this episode, but I'm sure that you'll catch up, and we'll get there. Anyway, lovely to have you back. How are you? You all right?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm very good. Just all excited at those little hints of action figures coming. A Sixth Doctor and Ultimate Adventure costume, it would appear, and a First Doctor, Richard Turndle. Oh, there we go. That's me messed up now. So, oh, damn it. A Richard Turndle variant on the way. So I look forward to seeing what that looks like very soon, which of course means that Stephen Noonan is now the first actor, or the only actor, not to be portrayed as the First Doctor in plastic form.
What about Jeffrey Baildon?
Well, was he?
Edmund Warwick?
Oh, all right, Edmund Warwick. Okay, damn it. Yep, you're right. Okay. I've got the giggles. I think you have to. Yes, I'm sorry, we've got the giggles. Anyway, yes, welcome back. And we shall be moving on very shortly to chat about something. This episode was, of course, completely inspired by you and one of your tweets. As we're not going to be heading forwards in time, we're going to be heading backwards in time and also rippling out sideways as we're talking about the end of the Eighth Doctor. And we don't mean the Night of the Doctor. We're talking about the way that Russell T. Davis intended for him to end the Time War with the Daleks.
We're going to be discussing Doctor Who and the Time War, the end of a novelisation that never was, which Russell planned for 2013. Although, as we're about to hear, his own memory was cheating when he found it in his files.
This was never meant to exist. Way back, maybe early 2013, Tom Spilsbury, the editor of Doctor Who magazine, asked me if I wanted to contribute to Doctor Who magazine's great 50th special, maybe addressing that huge gap in Doctor Who lore. How did the Eighth Doctor regenerate into the Ninth? I said, well, yeah, no, but isn't that best left to the imagination? If I write a script, it would be too real, too fixed, too canonical. But Tom's never one to give up. He said, okay, what if you wrote, say, the final pages of a Target novel about the last days of the Time War, the Doctor's final moments, and we could present it like a surviving fragment of the novel that never was? So it exists in that half-real space of the spin-offs, possible but not factual, just slightly canon, if you so choose. Okay, Tom, you temptress, I'm in. So I wrote this. It even starts mid-sentence, as if you've just turned to the last pages. Lee Binding created a beautiful cover. We were excited. And then Tom said, I'd better run this past Stephen Moffat, just in case. Oh, said Stephen. Oh, how could we have known? That Day of the Doctor would have an extra Doctor, a War Doctor. And Stephen didn't even tell us about Night of the Doctor. He kept that regeneration a complete surprise. He just said, sorry, can you lay off that whole area? I agreed, harumphed, went to bed and told him he was sleeping on the settee that night. So the idea was snuffed a-borning. Until 2020, when a science fiction-shaped virus came along to change our lives. Honestly, I've written The End of the World 100 times, but I never imagined everyone just sitting at home. Emily Cook of Doctor Who magazine created the live stream of The Day of the Doctor, then turned to Rose and asked me if I had anything to offer. At exactly the same time, Chris Chibnall emailed me saying, we need the Doctor more than ever these days, and could I think of any material? By some miracle, this file still existed. And then, like a story within a story, I discovered that this chapter was nothing to do with Tom and Doctor Who magazine after all. My memory had become a blurry, spinning vortex. Truth is, it was actually written for BBC Books and was going to be part of their 50th anniversary book, The Doctor, His Life and Times. Lee still had his illustration, naturally, because he was under a binding contract. Oh, I'm so funny. And strangely, looking back, it's funny how things fit. The moment is described here as ochred brass, which isn't far from the final idea. I don't mean Billy. I wonder, I suspect without realising, if Stephen and I were both riffing off Eighth Doctor-style designs, maybe. More importantly, the idea has come of age. This chapter only died because it became, continuity-wise, incorrect. But now, the 13th Doctor has shown us Doctors galore, with infinite possibilities. All Doctors exist. All stories are true. So come with me now, to the distant reefs of a terrible war, as the Doctor takes the moment and changes both the universe and themselves forever.
And a big thanks to our special guest reader there for bringing that to life. Do you know who our special guest reader was, Matt?
No. Who was it?
It was Sean Carlson, Narvin.
Of course it was.
There we go.
I've just been listening to Gallifrey Time War. Box set 4. Very good.
Yeah.
And a great story for Sean in that as Narvin.
He's brilliant. And yes, that was all as a result of a Twitter plea. Asked if anybody can do a good Russell T impression, and Sean messaged me to say yes, I can do it, and he's very kindly recorded that for us, so I owe him a pint next time I see him. So hurrah, we've got bonus Narvin. Everybody loves Narvin.
We all love Narvin.
We do. That sounds like a sitcom. Anyway,
I just imagine Sean just wears that sort of black and white War Games tabard now.
Oh, he does. He's even got a pajama version of it
and underpants.
I didn't go that far. I don't know if you can get Narvin underpants like the VHS ones, but I've got them in my loft somewhere, my originals. I don't know if I should be revealing that, but talking about my underpants from when I was a child. Something very dodgy about that. Anyway, this story first appeared in the 2020 publication Doctor Who Adventures in Lockdown, featuring contributions from writers like Russell, Stephen Moffat, Chris Chibnall, Mark Gatiss, Neil Gaiman, Paul Cornell, and several others who've got TV credits on them, and we're holding our books up as we look at each other right now.
Yeah, beautiful. And the 13th Doctor's got a hood up on it. A face mask might have been a better protection against COVID than the hood of her coat, but, you know, there you are, just making an effort.
Maybe that's where Time Lords breathe through the top of their head, and that's like how she's protecting herself from COVID, so the mouth is fine, but that's where they'd inhale COVID germs.
Hair must be right mess if they sneeze.
Yeah, hair raising. That'd be good. That'd be when Alex McQueen would be fine as the Master. Wouldn't have any problems there.
How the 10th Doctor gets his hair to stick up like that.
Yeah, DIY hair gel. No, I'm not even going to go into another story I heard about that on the way to my first Fan Olympiad in 1992. But the gentleman who told me that is now bald, so probably not a good cure for baldness. It may work for hair gel, but definitely not
as a result of the Fan Olympiad.
Well, I know he had a good time at the Fan Olympiad, so I had quite a good time at the Fan Olympiad, but that's an entirely another story for a very, very different kind of podcast.
Okay, and now we're going to hear a slice of Lost Doctor Who.
The Daleks and the Time Lords scream in vain, too far away to stop him now. And so, the Doctor stands alone. He looks out from his eyrie across the wreckage of a thousand worlds. Below him, fragments of the Time War, broken reefs of Gallifrey and Scarrow, washed up into this backwater to rot. His creaking wooden platform shivers with ice, a mile high, atop fragments of Morbius's red capital, its vile towers fused into the black, friable spires of Yarveling's church. And yet, the Doctor can see glimpses of Earth. The planet has been replicated a million times to become the bullets fired into the Nightmare Child's skull, And now, splinters of human society have gouged themselves into the wasteland below. Relics of Mumbai, shards of Manhattan, a satire of old London town. Remnants of better days. The doctor looks down. Her skeleton lies at his feet. The bones relax into dust, and she is gone. The doctor looks up. In front of him, at the edge of the platform, a brass handle, mounted in a simple oak casement. The only remaining extrusion of the moment into this world, the rest of its vast bulk hidden, chained to an N-form, churning behind the dimensional wall, screaming to be used. He steps forward. He grips the handle. He wonders what his last words should be. He decides that last words are useless. He pulls the handle down, flat. The moment happens. The universe sings. The war ends. Surrounded by brightness, the Doctor sees the sky above parting to reveal, just as Betan and the Deathsmiths of Goth had predicted, the final event. Gallifrey Original convulses and rolls into flame. Its concentric rings of Dalek warships become silhouettes, then ashes, and then... The Doctor falls. Every atom around him is sucked upwards towards the fire, but he alone is capable of falling, saved or damned by the moment's shadow. Above him, he feels the time lock solidify, sealing off the war from reality, and as his body tumbles out of existence, into plasma space, then foul space, then beyond, the Doctor leans into the fall, head first, arms wide, diving into infinity. Alone. Except... there. Something else. Falling. Spinning? A whirl of blue, that faithful blue. Then a rectangle of white, widening, a doorway, coming closer, towards him. And as the grind of ancient engines reaches a crescendo, he thinks, I'm going home. The Doctor lies on the TARDIS floor. His bones broken from the fall, his heart's hollowed by his loss. Around him, the console room buckles, warps, shudders, still suffering from the High Council's resurrection of the Master long ago. It aches for a new shape. Me too, mutters the Doctor with a grim smile, though he knows regeneration is impossible. The moment has fixed his existence, and this life is his last. He wonders what age he's reached. The Time War used years as ammunition. At the Battle of Rodan's Wedding alone, he'd aged to 5 million, and then regressed to a mewling babe, merely from shrapnel. Now, the ache in his bones feels 1,000 years old? Well, call it 900. Sounds better. Darkness swirls through his mind, and he forces a smile, ready and yet never ready for the end. Still, no final words. But then, can it be? He feels it once more. That old deep stirring in every bone and muscle and thought. The joy, the terror, the change, the impossible change. Amazed, he lifts up his hand, stares, fascinated, as the skin ripples with a curious new gold. Of course, she tricked him right at the end. Her final kiss was not a goodbye. She imprinted the restoration within him. His life cycle has been reset, the new man lurching outwards to be born. So this is the meaning of her final song, a whole new body to expiate the guilt. He might even pass the restoration to another one day. Suddenly they come, in a rush, his final words. He says them aloud, and there is no one to hear, allowing them to be imagined and imagined again forever. Then his nuclei turn into stars. Every pore blazes with energy. A volcano of thick, viscous energy cannons from his neck, his hands, his feet, his guts, his heart, his soul. It stops. The doctor sits up. The new doctor, next doctor, now doctor. He lifts up his new fingers to touch his new head, his new chin, his new nose, his new ears. He takes a deep breath into his new, dry, wide lungs. He says his first word.
Blimey!
That's the way it's always been in my mind. That was how I originally envisaged the end of the Time War. I listened to variations in the theme for the first time in years and thought, that'd be a really good way to end it, having that playing. So there we go. Anyway, right, okay.
Not with K9 and Company's theme tune.
No, we're not.
Time War!
Anyway, that's... Don't even suggest that. I'm now feeling the urge to email John Leash and say, can you say the words Time War for me, a canine sort of kind of style? No, don't go there. Don't put ideas, mate. Right. Matt, this is one that, as I mentioned earlier, it was inspired by your good self, so it's appearing in this season rather than further down the line. So we'll talk about the rest of the book later, since there's not really any other Eighth Doctor stuff in there. This was a wee bit of a surprise, wasn't it, when it was first revealed in the BBC website?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it came in that sort of stretch in 2020 where you had RTD and Moffat and Chibnall scrabbling around to see what they had in the locker that might keep people entertained during that long, long period where we were all self-isolating and climbing the walls. And this one was particularly interesting kind of tidbit. Because obviously we'd had hints that the Eighth Doctor had been involved in the Time War before. I think really early on when they had the website that had been designed for this sort of 2005 launch, there was a snippet of report of someone of the Ninth Doctor wearing a sort of tattered velvet jacket staggering out of a junkyard, which obviously was meant to imply that he's just regenerated, presumably post the Time War. But we'd never really got much hint of how Russell envisaged the Eighth Doctor participating in events, and I think it's quite interesting to sort of see how it ends. It's very Russell Time War, with mentions of, you know, the Deathsmiths of Goth and Morbius and Yarvelling and that big inclusive encyclopedic knowledge of the canon and pulling everything in, rather than going sort of down that very narrow path of, well, it has to have been in The Deadly Assassin and it has to have been referenced in Ark of Infinity. It's like everything, comics, books, I don't know, the back of a cereal packet, a Weetabix card, everything's in there. It's all good.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, let's go through it page by page, given that there's only seven of the buggers to read. And I think that here we go, we join it just as it's just ending. And the Doctor, I mean, the detail here is just that lyrical stuff that we get, you know, hints at in the TV series, like the Jaws of the Nightmare Child and things like that. You know, sort of broken reefs of Gallifrey and Scarrow washed up, and Morbius's Red Capital and Yarveling's Church, as you mentioned, and all this stuff merged together, and Earth being replicated to destroy the Nightmare Child, and relics of human society being, it's just so Russell. And it's, and then of course right at the end we get her skeleton lies at his feet, yeah, and the bones relax into dust and she's gone. It's like, who is she? It's just this, it's just so Russell. It's brilliantly enigmatic.
Yes.
Well, good point.
It struck me as very Cass. I mean, I don't think Stephen had read this when he wrote Night of the Doctor at all. It sounds like it was written, as we've heard, before Russell and Stephen had talked about what was going to be in the Night of the Doctor and what the 50th anniversary was going to be all about. But again, the Eighth Doctor's sort of final hour is spent over the body of his last companion, and their death is what prompts him to make his final fateful decision. Of in the TV version, obviously, it's to become the War Doctor. Here, it's to end the war. But either way, it feels like the same sort of prompt causes that final fateful decision.
Yeah, very much. It's the symmetry there is quite incredible. Just sort of the death of a companion, and that's it. Sort of that's it. I've had enough. I'm going to do it. Having obviously held off for so long, and then we move into the second page, and the description of the moment again, as Russell mentioned, a brass handle and an oak casement. And it's very much fitting in with that TV movie TARDIS kind of feel, that Jules Verne kind of world, and a little nod to Russell's damaged goods there with an N form turning behind a dimensional wall, which is a nice wee nod there, which of course if you know your Russell T. Davis stuff, then that fits in perfectly.
It does. It's beautifully trailed in the Big Finish version of Damaged Goods as well, the N forms and their connection to the Time War. So I love the symmetry there. I also love the symmetry with what we actually got in Day of the Doctor, because there's a sort of reference to Gallifrey Prime being surrounded by Dalek ships. And in fact, what do we see on TV in Day of the Doctor? Gallifrey surrounded by Dalek ships. So again, Russell and Stephen coming from very different plots, but they're almost like converging in the same imagery, because it's so powerful as an image.
Absolutely agree, but I love the simplicity of it all. When he pulls the handle down flat, the moment happens, the universe sings, the war ends, and as simple as that, in 9 words, your billions of deaths have been, the internal conflict has just suddenly stopped. And just thinking, that is just, it's really powerful, that just sort of the simplicity of it all, just by the power of one weapon. And I say that Gallifrey Original, Deathsmith of Goth, all these wonderful mentions, and then the Doctor just plummets as everything goes into the fire and gets destroyed.
Yeah, I think it actually says the Doctor falls, and I was like, oh, I wonder if Stephen read that.
Yeah, for the Doctor's end. Very good. I hadn't even thought of that. Very good point. And then just the next page, we've got him. He feels the time lock solidify, sealing off the war, and he tumbles through, and then obviously the TARDIS is there to save him. It's just that, again, the fact that he's so close, it's just that falling through space thing, like a bit like the spaceship crashing, and there's just that feeling of the falling, sort of plummeting kind of thing, again another that which ultimately causes him to die.
And I think there's something that kind of comes back to an image that I've got in my head of the Eighth Doctor. I think in The Dying Days there's a big sequence of him falling from the Martian spaceship
with black bags, and
so that's obviously the last New Adventure, and then in the last Eighth Doctor adventure it ends with them all sort of leaping into, I think it's, they leap into a volcano or something to
defeat the Gallifrey Chronicles,
spoilers for the Gallifrey Chronicles. But again, I just associate the Eighth Doctor with these leaps into the unknown, with these sort of plummets, and I thought it was very on brand, deliberately or not.
Yeah, and then of course he lands in the TARDIS and his bones broken from the fall, and he's in the console room just, and there's obviously a reference to the TV movie, the TARDIS having suffered from the Master's resurrection. And of course, I think there were plans that Scott Hancock once told me that he'd planned for a story for the Master's resurrection, something that Russell had said, but Big Finish had by that point already resurrected him for the Alex McQueen Master, which had been fascinating to know what that was.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's interesting because it's one of the few specific things that actually link this to what we saw of the Eighth Doctor on TV. Because interestingly, the Doctor's not really described through these handful of pages. He doesn't really say anything. I mean, the illustration clearly shows it's meant to be the Eighth Doctor, but if you weren't told that it's definitely the Eighth Doctor, there's very few clues that you can actually sort of identify to say it's definitely that version. But I think this is one of them. The sort of resurrection of the Master is a clear link back to the TV movie, and the fact that Master is obviously eaten up by the TARDIS in that. Also a sort of link, I guess, again, to the Gallifrey Chronicles, where the Master's sort of rumbling around still inside the TARDIS.
Yeah. And again, there's some of that lovely prosaic text with the Battle of Rodan's Wedding.
Yes.
And the fact you've got the Time War used years as ammunition, just think that's just brutal.
Yeah, everyone thinks the War Doctor must have lived for ages because he's obviously very young when he first appears on screen in The Night of the Doctor, but he could have been there for a matter of weeks and just aged horribly by, I don't know, Time Destructor or something like that. It's just, yeah. Who knows?
The thing that's, of course, that a little bit of a cheeky laugh there with addressing the aging issue of the Doctor from 953 in Time and the Rani, yes, to 900 in Rose. So yeah, I do quite like that. It's a cheeky wee reference. And the artwork by Lee Binding, I love that. Isn't it beautiful? That would have been such a great Target Books cover.
No, absolutely. It makes me long for Russell to actually write this book, although there's no reason for it to ever happen now, but beautiful. So great. Timothy Dalton Russell on yep. Dalek, looking very Dalek-y as it sort of fires with some nice silhouettes behind.
Yeah,
it looks really very much in the tradition of the new Target styles, and that sort of slightly sort of shadowy version of the Doctor sort of looking fairly grim-faced as he stares out at us.
Yeah, the thing that I find quite weird, it's the juxtaposition of the TV movie McGann with the new series Dalek. I just find that really weird seeing that, even now, you know, I've been looking at it for days, this picture, when I knew we were going to be doing this, and it just feels really weird to me, but that's probably just me. And then, of course, at the bottom page, the regeneration begins to kick in, because, as we go over, he thought that his power or his ability to regenerate was gone, and she had given him a final kiss goodbye. Well, not a goodbye, is giving the restoration to restore his ability to regenerate. So part of me was thinking, is that something that the Daleks have done in the Time War? Done some sort of virus to stop Time Lords regenerating to try and destroy them? I don't know. That's a wonderful thing about this. It's so open to interpretation. You can come up with your own readings.
Yeah, the restoration, it's such a Russell thing, isn't it? Like the moment, it's, you could read 101 different things into that word, and you can create all of your own stories. I think Russell has that real talent of just dropping in an idea or an image and letting it play in your mind, and you can take it down so many different routes. He doesn't feel the need to like over-explain, like spend a whole episode explaining why something is what it is. It just drops in the little hint. Yeah. And your brain does the rest.
Yeah, I mean, particularly when it says he might even pass the restoration to another one day, which makes you think, obviously, Time Lords can't regenerate. Maybe that's how I've extrapolated that. So maybe you'd have to think about giving the Master a kiss one day to make him better if he'd survived. But then it's very interesting to read a regeneration in text form, isn't it? His nuclei turn into stars, and then just going through it. I mean, we can picture it so easily.
I wonder if that was like the sort of kiss is foreshadowing of the parting of the ways, and that's how he brings Rose back, that kiss that they have at the end.
Yes!
The parting of the ways, and it's meant to sort of bring that idea full circle, that he's not just like sucking the time vortex out of her, but he's like passing on something of the restoration to Rose to bring her back.
Oh, Matt, you're good. I like that. There's a lovely symmetry there, sort of as one Doctor is restored by it, and then he passes the gift on to restore someone else, and then just like the words of, as it, you know, continues as we meet the new Doctor, and I mean simply just it stops. The Doctor sits up, the new Doctor, next Doctor, now Doctor. And then we get Eccleston's first word is, blimey.
I know. But interestingly, the Eighth Doctor, again, his last words are not recorded. He says something, but no one's there to hear it, and Russell doesn't record what it might be. Maybe it was Physician Heal Thyself, who knows? But again, he doesn't actually speak, or he doesn't actually say anything that we hear through the entire story. It's all his feelings, it's all his reactions, it's all that sort of moment of decision. And amazing.
It gets, I think it's two words, me too, and that's it.
Yes.
And that's the last word. Yes. But yes, it's lovely to have that. Again, it's wide open. We don't get to know what his last words are. We get that mystery there, and just that. I just think that first word for Eccleston, I'm still taking that as continuity. That would be the word that he would have said anyway.
Yeah, if that scene in Day of the Doctor had gone on another 20 seconds, we would have got that.
Have you ever seen the fan edit of that, where they continue it? It's very good.
I haven't, but I will be YouTubing it after this.
Yeah, it's just carries on, just like for another 10 seconds or so, and we get the full shot as he comes in. And I'm sure that I may have seen, I'm sure there was a couple of versions, and there's one where it had him blinking. So I could be wrong. Maybe I'm misremembering, but I'm sure that I saw that back in the day when I were a lad. Maybe it's because I'm old and I'm misremembering. But I just think just looking back at it, I think that is a lovely way. I mean, if we didn't have Night of the Doctor, I would have been more than satisfied with that as being how the Time War ended.
No, I agree. It's very evocative. It's very of a piece with what we see in the end of time. And it's a lovely little vignette, a glimpse of what might have been, probably still is in some version of the Time War. I mean, it was fought over and over again. People died and resurrected time and time again to be killed in new and unusual ways, as we got told in the end of time. So who knows how many times the war ended and was restored.
That's a great thought. I mean, I think it's a wonderful short story. And the fact, I mean, look how much analysis we've given it. 7 pages in quite big text, and they're not even like full pages. And there's just so much in there. I mean, that's just typical Russell T. Davis prose for you. There's just so much detail crammed in there, but it's presented in such a throwaway and easily read way. And I love it. I absolutely love it for that. And it's actually worth the cover price of the book in its own, which is £8.99, in which £2.25 from the sale of that goes to BBC Children in Need, which is registered charities in England and Wales and Scotland. So please do buy it. Matt, tell us your highlights from the rest of the book, because obviously you picked some bits out for your blog.
Yeah, I did. So the blog is rapidly, in fact, by the time this goes out, it might have ended, but I did a entry on the 2020 lockdown adventures, which many of which are either transcribed here if they were sort of dramatized, or they are just or they were just always short stories. I think the ones that were highlights for me, I think my favorite one is The Secret of Novice Haim, which is also by Russell T. Davies, and it sort of closes this collection, and it's just a beautiful vignette of the 10th Doctor encountering Novice Haim from New Earth in Gridlock right at the end of her life, as she wants to tell him her final secret. And it's got a beautiful, wistful air to it. It's a lovely piece of prose. I really enjoyed that. I think Revenge of the Nestine, another Russell T. Davies entry, is very, very funny. And it's got a message from the Doctor, which is the Jodie Whittaker YouTube sort of appeal that started off all of the lockdown adventures. That was kind of a nice thing to do. But there are a number of good stories in here. It doesn't include Moffat's story for Nardole and Bill, which was a lovely sort of return for Matt Lucas and Pearl Mackie. Which is a bit of a shame, but that was very entertaining. But it does have a sort of creepy poem by Moffat as well, called Listen, which ties in nicely to the TV episode and has a kind of sinister air to it. Yeah, it's a collection that's well worth picking out. There's a sort of story for the Corsair by Neil Gaiman, so it delves into some of the byways of Doctor Who lore. Yeah, so it's a nice little collection for £9. And by some of the luminaries of the show as well, you've got, as well as sort of Moffat and Russell, you've got Joy Wilkinson, who did the Witchfinders episode, which is one of the stronger Jodie Whittaker episodes. It's obviously got Neil Gaiman, I've mentioned. It's got Paul Cornell, Pete McTighe, Mark Gatiss. So it's a good collection of people that you might not always find in the short story collection for Doctor Who.
Very well summed up. That was perfect. And of course, let's give your blog a wee mention where people can find it.
Yeah, it's matthewmichael.org, and it's called Next Time, and it is an episode by episode, literally episode by episode. So I do reviews of like The Mutants episode 3 and then episode 4 to try and recapture the experience of watching it at the time and taking each episode on its own merits rather than subsuming it in a bigger 6 or 7 part story. But yeah, I'm racing towards the end of Jodie Whittaker and the end of the blog.
Well, for now.
For now.
Given that there'll be
some find something else to do in the interim.
Yeah, so there's some new episodes in November, and yeah, I'm sure you'll be able to find something. I mean, one of my favourite things is the book Memoirs of an Edwardian Adventurer, which looks at the Eighth Doctor's adventures in audio episode by episode, which we did an episode on, last year at some point, and it's a damn good read. And thoroughly entertaining. I disagree with a lot of it, as I told the fellas when they were on, but yeah, I love that episode by episode daily reviews. There's something about it just makes it entertaining.
I think if you watch particularly old school Doctor Who or Big Finish, if you eat it all in one go, then you don't necessarily appreciate the nuance and the effort that goes into each of the individual pieces. So it was slowing myself down and forcing myself to watch right, particularly on the old stuff that I've always just consumed as, I don't know, Inferno, as a massive 7-part thing before. You do notice things and spot things that you haven't ever really thought about before.
Fantastic. Well, I'd recommend people go and read it, particularly for your review of the TV movie.
Yes, thank you very much.
Let's be on brand.
And Sharda's there, yeah, the other BBC Eighth Doctor story. Definitely go and seek that out. And if you've enjoyed today's Pieces of Eighth, or indeed liked any episode that we've done, please do leave a review for us on iTunes or your podcast provider, as it means more people can find our episodes. And who wouldn't thank you for being able to find more Eighth Doctor content, I think. It's
true.
A public duty, to be honest.
Yep. Do you know that this week...
It would be shameful not to.
It would. I completely agree. Thank you, Matt. This week, we were actually got up to number 63 in the podcast chart in Ireland. We were the 63... For one day, we were the 63rd most listened to podcast in the Republic of Ireland.
Very, very on brand. 63 and all that.
Yeah, I was quite pleased by that. So, yeah. But we've not had a review in a while. So please, if you do have a couple of minutes to spare, please do write us one. And if you've done one before, please do another if you're still enjoying. And remember, you can follow the podcast on Twitter at Pieces of Eighth. And I think we'll need to start one in Threads too. Perhaps for the next season, we'll do that. So it's all there.
I think that's what I'll do now. Now I'm finishing the blog, I could just write a review a day of Pieces of Eight.
Oh, there we go. Well, this is episode number 113 or something like that.
I'll keep me going for the rest of the year.
But there you go. And you can review yourself and review your own performance. And
10 out of 10.
There you go. I was going to give
it 5 Tardises.
Oh, mate, get back on brand and be 8 out of 8. But yes, good old Russell's Retometer. Russell's Retometer makes a return. There's one for all you DWM fans of yesteryear. So, yes. But also, we have a Facebook group, and feel free to send us a request to join that and find out what we've got coming up, as well as some general chit chat in the chat group, which is quite good fun. If you haven't used that, then I'd recommend that, because you get us having some chat with listeners and seeing what we're up to. It can be social chat, it can be Eighth Doctor listening chat, it can be anything. Just a nice little social community. And Matt, you're going to be back with us next week, as we have a look at the Little Book of Fate. The Little Book of Fate, the new Eighth Doctor story, which has appeared in the new Warrior's Gate novelisation by Stephen Gallagher. And I've had a chat with Steve about that, and speaking with Steve Cole as well.
Can't wait. I thought you're going to be, if it's the Little Book of Faith, I thought you're going to be one of those people that stands by the railway station gates. And
no, that's not my...
We could do that with the podcast.
We could listen to us and then sort of give us your reviews, hand out flyers, pieces of eight to anyone. And I'm sure that people just listening in their thousands, because we just know that's what they want to do. Actually, thinking about it, people would probably come and chat to us more than they chat to people about the religious stuff, knowing what some people are like. So, yeah, we might have a chance there.
But which Eighth Doctor costume would you be wearing?
Well, I'd like to try and be cool. I've never owned a leather jacket in my life, so I might go for the Dark Eyes kind of look, but I don't think I could carry it off. Well, I know, probably, that. Actually, thinking about it, because I always look really uncomfortable when I'm in a suit or something stylish, I just can't, it just doesn't look like me. So yeah, probably go with that one, because it's t-shirt, jeans, and a blue leather jacket. I can go for that.
Yeah, I'd just go for the sheet from the mall.
The Shroud of Sorrow.
I think that's very on brand.
It is. It is
a little book of faith.
Yeah. I do. I mean, yes, physician, heal thyself. And yes, there we go. We can just chat about McGann's religious iconography. I can see it, and with the Crown of Thorns and the TV movie, and then Physician Heal Thyself, it's all there, and particularly in James Currie Smith's Night of the Doctor book.
It's all there in The Power of the Doctor as well. They nick that whole master body swapping with the Doctor for The Power of the Doctor. That's basically the plot. It's a sequel to the TV movie, can you?
Yeah, he always likes to dress for the occasion, so.
He does, he even says it, yes, you're right.
Yeah. Oh my word. At least we know it's properly been canonised now by that. So, first direct reference to it. He never made a half-human reference, but other than that, we're good. So, there we go.
True.
Anyway, Matt, thanks once again for your time. And until next week, I've been Kenny Smith.
And I was Matt Michael. Thank you.
Let's set the controls and disappear for 7 days, and then we'll come back next week.
Shumanian era, here we come.
Woohoo!